This is Rachel, recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with part 15 of Dracula by Bram Stoker. Dr. Seward's Diary. 29th of October. This is written in the train from Varna to Galatz. Last night we all assembled a little before the time of sunset. Each of us had done his work as well as he could. As far as thought and endeavor and opportunity go, we are prepared for the whole of our journey and for our work when we get to Galatz. When the usual time came round, Mrs. Harker prepared herself for her hypnotic effort, and after a longer and more strenuous effort on the part of Dr. Van Helsing than has been usually necessary, she sank into the trance. Usually she speaks on a hint, but this time the professor had to ask her questions, and to ask them pretty resolutely before we could learn anything. At last her answer came. I see nothing. We are still. There are no waves lapping, only the steady swirl of water softly running against the hawser. I can hear men's voices calling near and far, and the roll and creak of oars in the rowlocks. A gun is fired somewhere. The echo of it seems far away. There is tramping of feet overhead, and ropes and chains are dragged along. What is this? There is a gleam of light. I can feel the air blowing upon me. Here she stopped. She had risen, as if impulsively, from where she lay on the sofa, and raised both of her hands, palm upwards, as if lifting a weight. Van Helsing and I looked at each other with understanding. Quincy raised his eyebrows slightly and looked at her intently, whilst Harker's hand instinctively closed round the hilt of his kukri. There was a long pause. We all knew that the time when she could speak was passing, but we felt like it was useless to say anything. Suddenly she sat up, and as she opened her eyes, said sweetly, "Would none of you like a cup of tea? You must be so tired." We would only make her happy, and so acquiesced. She bustled off to get tea, and when she had gone, Van Helsing said, "You see, my friends, he is close to land. He has left his earth chest, but he has yet to get on shore. In the night he may lie hidden somewhere, but if he be not carried on shore, or if the ship do not touch it, he cannot achieve the land." In such a case he can, if it be in the night, change his form, and can jump or fly on shore, as he did at Whitby. But if the day come before he get on shore, then, unless he be carried, he cannot escape. And if he be carried, then the customs may discover what the box contains. Thus, in fine, if he escape not on shore tonight, or before dawn, there will be the whole day lost to him. We may then arrive in time, for if he escape not at night, we shall come to him in daytime, boxed up and at our mercy, for he dare not be his true self, awake and visible, lest he be discovered." There was no more to be said, so we waited in patience until the dawn, at which time we might learn more from Mrs. Harker. Early this morning we listened, with breathless anxiety, for her response in the trance. The hypnotic stage was even longer in coming than before, and when it came the time remaining until full sunrise was so short we began to despair. Van Helsing seemed to throw his whole soul into the effort. At last, in obedience to his will, she made reply, "All is dark. I hear lapping water, level with me, and some creaking as of wood on wood." She paused, and the red sun shot up. "We must wait till tonight." And so it is that we are traveling towards Galatz with an agony of expectation. We are due to arrive between 2 and 3 in the morning, but already at Bucharest we are 3 hours late, so we cannot possibly get in till well after sunup. Thus, we shall have 2 more hypnotic messages from Mrs. Harker. Either or both may possibly throw more light on what is happening. Later. Sunset has come and gone. Fortunately, it came at a time when there was no distraction, for it had occurred whilst we were at the station. We would not have secured the necessary calm and isolation. Mrs. Harker yielded to the hypnotic influence even less readily than this morning. I am in fear that her power of reading the Count's sensations may die away just when we want it most. It seems to me that her imagination is beginning to work. While she's been in the trance hitherto, she's confined herself to the simplest of facts. If this goes on, it may ultimately mislead us. If I thought that the Count's power over her would die away equally with her power of knowledge, it would be a happy thought, but I'm afraid it may not be so. When she did speak, her words were enigmatical. "Something's going out. I can feel it pass me like a cold wind. I can hear far off confused sounds, as if men talking in strange tongues, fierce falling water, and the howling of wolves. She stopped, and a shudder ran through her, increasing the intensity for a few seconds, till, in the end, she shook as though in a palsy. She said no more, even in answer to the professor's imperative questioning. When she woke from the trance, she was cold and exhausted and languid. But her mind was all alert. She could not remember anything, but asked what she said. When she was told, she pondered over it deeply for a long time and in silence. 30th of October, 7 a.m. We are near Galatz now, and I may not have time to write later. Sunrise this morning was anxiously looked for by us all. Knowing of the increasing difficulty of procuring the hypnotic trance, Van Helsing began his passes earlier than usual. They produced no effect, however, until the regular time when she yielded with a still greater difficulty only a minute before the sun rose. The professor lost no time in his questioning. Her answer came with equal quickness. All is dark. I hear water swirling by, level with my ears, and the creaking of wood on wood. Cattle low, far off. There's another sound. A queer one, like... She stopped and grew white, and whiter still. Go on. Go on. Speak. I command you, said Van Helsing in an agonized voice. At the same time, there was despair in his eyes, for the rising sun was reddening even Mrs. Harker's pale face. She opened her eyes, and we all started as she said, sweetly and seemingly with the utmost concern, Oh, Professor, why do you ask me to do what you know I can't? I don't remember anything. Then, seeing the look of amazement on our faces, she said, turning from one to the other with a troubled look, What have I said? What have I done? I know nothing, only that I was lying here half asleep and heard you say, Go on, speak, I command you. It seemed so funny to hear you order me about as if I were a bad child. Oh, Madam Mina, he said sadly, it is proof, if proof be needed, of how I love and honor you, when a word for your good, spoken more earnest forever, can seem so strange because it is to order her whom I am proud to obey. The whistles are sounding. We are nearing Galatz. We are on fire with anxiety and eagerness. Mina Harker's Journal, 30th of October. Mr. Morris took me to a hotel where our rooms had been ordered by telegraph, he being the one who could best be spared, since he does not speak any foreign language. The forces were distributed much as they had been at Varna, except that Lord Godalming went to the vice-consul, as his rank might serve as an immediate guarantee to some sort of the official, being that we were in extreme hurry. Jonathan and the two doctors went to the shipping agent to learn particulars of the arrival of the Tsarina Catherine. Later. Lord Godalming has returned. The consul is away, and the vice-consul sick, so the routine work has been attended to by a clerk. He was very obliging, and offered to do anything in his power. Jonathan Harker's Journal, 30th of October. At 9 o'clock, Dr. Van Helsing, Dr. Stewart, and I, and called on Messrs. Mackenzie and Steinkopf, the agents of the London firm of Hapgood. They had received a wire from London in answer to Lord Godalming's telegraphed request, asking them to show us any civility in their power. They were more than kind and courteous, and took us at once on board the Tsarina Catherine, which lay at anchor out in the river harbor. There sat the captain, Donaldson by name, who had told us of his voyage. He said that in all his life he had never had so favorable a run. Man, he said, but it made us afeard, so we expected that we should have to pay for it with some rare piece of ill luck, so as to keep up the average. It's no canny to run frae London to the Black Sea with a wind, ain't ya? As though the deil himself was blawing your sail for his ain purpose. Ain was a time we could no spear a thing. Gin as we were nigh a ship or a port or a headland, a fog fell on us and travelled with us, till it was lifted and we looked out, and the deil of thing could we see. We ran by Gibraltar without being able to signal, until we came to the Dardanelles we had to wait for our permit to pass. We never were within hail aught. At first I inclined to slack off sail and beat about till the fog was lifted, but whiles I thought that if the deil was minded to get us to the Black Sea quick, well, he was like to do it whether we would or no. If we had a quick voyage, it would be no to miscredit the owners, and no hurt to our traffic, and the old man, who served his ain purpose, would be decently grateful to us for not hindering him. This mixture of simplicity and cunning of superstition and commercial reasoning aroused Van Helsing, who said, "Mein friend, that devil is no much clever than he thought is thought by some, and he know when he meet his match." The skipper was not displeased with the compliment and went on. "When we got past the Bosphorus, the man began to grumble. Some of them, the Romanians, came and asked me to heave overboard a big box which had been put on board by a queer-looking old man just before we started for London. I'd seen them spear at the fellow and put out their fingers when they saw him to guard against the evil eye. Man, but that superstition of foreigners is perfectly ridiculous. I sent them about their business pretty quick, but just as a fog closed in on us, I felt a wee bit as they did announce something, although I wouldn't say it was again the bit box. Well, as we went, the fog didn't let up for 5 days. I just let the wind carry us, for the devil wanted us to get somewhere as well. He would fetch it up a reet. And if I didn't, well, we'd keep a sharp lookout anyhow. Sure enough, we had a fair way and deep water all the time, and 2 days ago, when the sun came through the fog, we found ourselves right in the river opposite Glatz. The Romanians were wild and wanted me right or wrong to take out the box and flint it into the river. I had to argue with them about it with a handspike, and when the last of them rose off the deck with his head in his hand, I convinced them that, evil eye or no evil eye, the property and trust of my owners were better in my hands than in the river Danube. And they had, mind ye, taken the box on the deck, ready to fling in, and as it was marked Galatz via Varna, I thought I'd let it lie until we were discharged in port and get rid of it altogether. We didn't do much clearing that day, and had to remain the night at anchor, but in the morning, broad and early, an hour before sunup, a man came aboard with an order written to him from England to receive a box marked for one Count Dracula. Sure enough, the matter was one ready for his hand. He had his papers and rate, and glad as I was to be rid of the damn thing, I was beginning myself to feel uneasy at it. If the devil did have any luggage aboard the ship, I was thinking none either than that same. "What was the name of the man who took it?" asked Dr. Van Helsing, with restrained eagerness. "I'll be telling you quick," he answered, and stepping down to his cabin produced a receipt signed Emanuel Hildesheim. Bergenstrasse 16 was the address. We found out that this was all the captain knew, so with thanks we came away. We found Hildesheim in his office, a Hebrew of rather the Adelphi Theatre type, with a nose like a sheep and a fez. His arguments were pointed with specie. We knew the punctuation, and with a little bargaining he told us what he knew. This turned out to be simple but important. He had received a letter from Mr. Deville of London, telling him to receive, if possible before sunrise to avoid customs, a box which would arrive at Galatz in the Tsarina Catherine. This he was to give in trade to a certain Petrov Skinsky, who dealt with the Slovaks who traded down at the river of the port. He had been paid for his work by an English banknote which had been duly cashed for gold at the Danube International Bank. When Skinsky had come to him, he had taken him to the ship and handed over the box so as to save porterage. That was all he knew. When we sought for Skinsky, we were unable to find him. One of his neighbors, who did not seem to bear him any affection, said that he had gone away 2 days before, no one knew whither. This was corroborated by his landlord, who had received by messenger the key of the house together with the rent due in English money. This had been between 10 and 11 o'clock last night. We are at a standstill once again. Whilst we were talking, one came running and breathlessly gasped that the body of Skinsky had been found inside the wall of the churchyard of St. Peter, and that the throat had been torn open as if by some wild animal. Those we had been speaking with ran off to see the horror, the women crying out, "This is the work of a Slovak!" We hurried away, lest we should have in some way been drawn into the affair and so detained. As we came home, we could arrive with no definite conclusion. We were all convinced that the box was on its way, by water, to somewhere. But where that would be, we would have to discover. With heavy hearts, we came home to the hotel, to Mina. When we met together, the first thing was to consult as to taking Mina again into our confidence. Things are getting desperate, and it was least a chance, though a hazardous one. As a preliminary step, I was released from my promise to her. Mina Harker's Journal, October 30th, evening. They were so tired and worn out and dispirited that there was nothing to be done till they had some rest. So I asked them all to lie down for half an hour whilst I should enter everything up to the moment. I feel so grateful to the man who invented the traveler's typewriter, and to Mr. Morris for getting this one for me. I should have felt quite astray doing the work if I had to write it with a pen. It is all done. Poor dear. Poor Jonathan. What he must have suffered. What he must be suffering now. He lies on the sofa, hardly seeming to breathe, and his whole body appears in collapse. His brows are knit. His face is drawn with pain. Poor fellow. Maybe he's thinking, and I can see his face all wrinkled up with the concentration of his thoughts. Oh, if only I could help at all. I shall do what I can. I've asked Dr. Van Helsing, and he's got me all the papers that I have not yet seen. Whilst they are resting, I shall go over all of them carefully, and perhaps I may arrive at some conclusion. I shall try to follow the professor's example, and think without prejudice on the facts before me. I do believe that under God's providence I have made a discovery. I shall get the maps and look over them. I am more sure than ever that I am right. My new conclusion is ready, and so I shall get our party together and read it. They can judge it. It is well to be accurate, and every minute is precious. Mina Harker's memorandum entered in her journal. Ground of inquiry. Count Dracula's problem is to get back to his own place. A. He must be brought back by someone. This is evident, for had he the power to move himself as he wished, he could go either as man, as wolf, or bat, or in some other way. He evidently fears discovery or interference. In a state of helplessness in which he must be, confined as he is between dawn and sunset to his wooden box. B. How is he to be taken? Here is a process of exclusions may help us. By road, by rail, or by water? 1. By road. There are endless difficulties, especially in leaving a city. There are people, and they are curious and investigate. A hint, a surmise, a doubt as to what might be in the box would destroy him. There are, or might be, customs or octroi pass officers to pass. His pursuers might follow. This is his greatest fear, and in order to prevent his being betrayed, he has repelled, as far as he can, even his victim, me. 2. By rail. There is no one in charge of the box. It would have to take its chance of being delayed, and delay would be fatal, with enemies on the track. True, he might escape at night, but what would he be if left in a strange place with no refuge that he could fly to? This is not what he intends, and he does not mean to risk it. 3. By water. Here is the safest way, with one respect, but with most danger in another. On the water, he is powerless except at night. Even then, he can only summon fog and storm and snow and his wolves. But were he wrecked, the living water would engulf him, helpless, and he would indeed be lost. He could have the vessel drive to land, but if it were unfriendly land, wherein he were not free to move, his position would still be desperate. We know from the record that he was on the water, so what we have to do is ascertain what water. The first thing is to realize exactly what he has done as yet. We may then first get a light on what his later task is to be. Firstly, we must differentiate between what he did in London as part of his general plan of action, when he was pressed for moments and had to arrange as best he could. Second, we must see, as well as we can surmise it from the facts that we know of, what he's done here. As to the first, he evidently intended to arrive at Galatz and sent invoice to Varna to deceive us, lest we should ascertain his means of exit from England. His immediate and sole purpose, then, was to escape. The proof of this is the letter of instructions sent to Emanuel Hildesheim to clear and take away the box before sunrise. There's also the instruction to Petrov Skinsky. There we must only guess at, but there must have been some letter or message since Skinsky came to Hildesheim. That, so far, his plans were successful, we know. The Tsarina Catherine made a phenomenally quick journey, so much that the Captain Donaldson's suspicions were aroused, but his superstition united with his canniness played the Count's game for him, and he ran with his favoring wind through fogs and all till he brought up blindfold at Galatz. That the Count's arrangements were well made has been proved. Hildesheim cleared the box, took it off, and gave it to Skinsky. Skinsky took it, and here we lose the trail. We only know that the box is somewhere on the water, moving along. The customs and the octroi, if there be any, have been avoided. Now we come to what the Count must have done after his arrival on land at Galatz. The box was given to Skinsky before sunrise. At sunrise, the Count could appear in his own form. Here, we ask why Skinsky was chosen at all to aid in the work. In my husband's diary, Skinsky is mentioned as dealing with the Slovaks who trade down at the river of the port, and the man's remark that the murder was the work of a Slovak showed the general feeling against his class. The count wanted isolation. My surmise is this, that in London, the count decided to get back to his castle by water as the most safe and secret way. He was brought from the castle by Zagany, and probably they delivered their cargo to Slovaks, who took the boxes to Varna, and from there they were shipped to London. Thus, the count has knowledge of the persons who could arrange this service. When the box was on land before sunrise or after sunset, he came out of his box, met Skinsky, and instructed him what to do so as arranging the carriage on the box up some river. When this was done, and he knew that all was in train, he blotted out his traces, as he thought, by murdering his agent. I have examined the map, and find that the river most suitable for the Slovaks to have ascended is either the Pruth or the Sarath. I read in the typescript in my trance, I heard cows low and water swirling level with my ears, and the creaking of wood. The count is in his box, then, when it was on a river in an open boat, propelled probably either by oars or poles, for the banks are near and it is working against stream. There would be no such sound if floating downstream. Of course, it may not be either the Sereth or the Pruth, but we may possibly investigate further. Now, of these two, the Pruth is the more easily navigated, but the Sereth is, at Fundu, joined by the Bistrica, which runs up around the Borgo Pass. The loop it makes is manifestly as close to Dracula's castle as can be got by water. Mina Harker's journal continued. When I had done reading, Jonathan took me in his arms and kissed me. The others kept shaking me with both hands, and Dr. Van Helsing said, "Our dear Madame Mina is once more our teacher. Her eyes have seen where we have been blinded. Now we are back on track once again, and this time we may succeed. Our enemy is at his most helpless, and if we can come to him by day on the water, our task will be over. He has a start, but he is powerless to hasten, as he may not leave his box, lest those who carry him may suspect. For them to suspect would be to prompt them to throw him into the stream where he perish. This he knows, and will not. Now, men, to our council of war, for here and now we must plan what each and all shall do." "I shall get a steam launch and follow him," said Lord Godalming. "And I horses to follow on the bank, lest he chance be by land," said Mr. Morris. "Good," said the professor, "both good, but neither must go alone. There must be force to overcome force if need be. The Slovak is strong and rough, and he carries rude arms." All the men smiled, for amongst them they carried a small arsenal. Said Mr. Morris, "I have brought some Winchesters. They're pretty handy in a crowd, and there may be wolves. The Count, if you remember, took some other precautions. He made some requisitions on others that Mrs. Harker could not yet hear or understand. We must be ready at all points." Dr. Seward said, "I think I better go with Quincy. We've been accustomed to hunt together, and we too, well armed, will be a match for whatever may come along. You must not be alone, Art. It may be necessary to fight the Slovaks, and a chance thrust, for I don't suppose these fellows carry guns, would undo all of our plans. There must be no chances this time. We must not rest until the Count's head and body have been separated, and we are sure that he cannot reincarnate." He looked at Jonathan as he spoke, and Jonathan looked at me. I could see that the poor dear was torn about in his mind. Of course he wanted to be with me, but then the boat service would most likely be the one which would destroy the vampire. Why did I hesitate to write that word? He was silent a while. During his silence, Dr. Van Helsing spoke. "Friend Jonathan, this is to you for twice reasons. First, because you are young and brave and can fight, and all energies may be needed at the last. And again, that it is your right to destroy him, that which has wrought such woe to you and yours. Be not afraid for Madame Mina. She will be in my care, if I may. I am old, my legs are not so quick as to run at once, and I am not used to ride so long or to pursue a need be or fight with lethal weapons. But I can be of other service. I can fight in other way. And I can die, if need be, as well as younger men. Now let me say that I would is this. While you, my Lord Godalming, and friend Jonathan, go in your swift little steamboat up the river, and whilst John and Quincy guard the bank where perchance he might be landed, I will take Madam Mina right into the heart of the enemy's country. Whilst the old fox is tied in his box, floating on the running stream, whence he cannot escape to land, where he dares not raise the lid of his coffin box, lest his Slovak carriers should in fear leave him to perish, we shall go in the track where Jonathan went, from Bistritz over the Borgo, and find our way to the castle of Dracula. Here, Madam Mina's hypnotic power will surely help, and we shall find our way, all dark and otherwise unknown, after the first sunrise when we are near that fateful place. There is much to be done, and other places to be made sanctify, so that the nest of vipers be obliterated. Here Jonathan interrupted him hotly. Do you mean to say, Professor Van Helsing, that you would bring Mina, in her sad case, and tainted as she is with the devil's illness, right into the jaws of his death-trap? Not for the world, not for heaven or hell. He became almost speechless for a minute, and then went on. Do you know what that place is? Have you seen that awful den of hellish infamy, with the very moonlight alive with grisly shapes, and every speck of dust that whirls in the wind a devouring monster in embryo? Have you felt the vampire's lips upon your throat? Here he turned to me, and as his eyes lit on my forehead, he threw up his arms with a cry. Oh, my God, what have we done to have this terror upon us? And he sank down into the sofa in a collapse of misery. The professor's voice, as he spoke in clear, sweet tones, which seemed to vibrate in the air, calmed us all. Oh, my friend, it is because I would save Madam Mina from that awful place that I would go. God forbid that I take her into that place. There is work, wild work, to be done there, that her eyes may not see. We men here, all save Jonathan, have seen with their own eyes what is to be done before that place can be purified. Remember that we are in terrible straits. If the Count escape us this time, and he is strong and subtle and cunning, he may choose to sleep him a century, and then, in time, our dear one, he took my hand, would come to him to keep him company, and would be as those others that you, Jonathan, saw. You have told us of their gloating lips. You heard their ribald laugh as they clutched the moving bag that the Count threw to them. You shudder, and well it may be. Forgive me that I make you so much pain, but it is necessary. My friend, is it not a dire need of the which I am giving, if need be, my life? If it were that anyone else were to go into that place to stay, it is I that would have to go to keep them company. Do as you will, said Jonathan, with a sob that shook him all over. We're in the hands of God. Later. Oh, it did me good to see the way these brave men worked. How can women help loving men when they were so earnest and so true and so brave? And too, it made me think of the wonderful power of money. What can it not do when it is properly applied, and what it might do when basely used? I felt so thankful that Lord Godalming is rich, and both he and Mr. Morris, who also has plenty of money, are willing to spend it so freely. For if they did not, our little expedition could not start, either so promptly or so well equipped, as it will within another hour. It is not 3 hours since it was arranged what part each of us was to do, and now Lord Godalming and Jonathan have a lovely steam launch with steam ready to start up at a moment's notice. Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris have half a dozen beautiful horses, so well appointed. We have all the maps and appliances of various kinds that can be had. Professor Van Helsing and I are to leave by the 11:40 train tonight to Vuresti, where we are to get a carriage to drive to the Borgo Pass. We are bringing a good deal of ready money, as we are to buy a carriage and horses. We shall drive ourselves, for we have no one whom we can trust in the matter. The professor knows something of a great many languages, so we shall get on all right. We've all got arms. Even for me, a large bore revolver. Jonathan would not be happy unless I was armed like the rest. Alas, I cannot carry one arm that the rest do. The scar on my forehead forbids that. Dear Dr. Van Helsing comforts me by telling me that I am fully armed as there may be wolves. The weather is getting colder every hour, and there are snow flurries which come and go as warnings. Later. It took all my courage to say goodbye to my darling. We may never meet again. Courage, Mina. The professor is looking at you keenly. His look is a warning. There must be no tears now, unless it may be that God will let them fall in gladness. Jonathan Harker's journal. 30th of October, night. I'm writing this in the light of some of the furnace door of the steam launch. Lord Godalming is firing up. He's an experienced hand at the work, as he has had for years a launch of his own on the Thames, and another on the Norfolk Broads. Regarding our plans, we finally decided that Mina's guess was correct, and that if any waterway was chosen for the Count's escape back to his castle, the Sereth and then the Bistritza at its junction would be the one. We took it, and somewhere about the 47th degree north latitude would be the place chosen for crossing the country between the river and the Carpathians. We have no fear in running at good speed up the river at night. There's plenty of water, and the banks are wide enough apart to make steaming, even in the dark, easy enough. Lord Godalming tells me to sleep for a while, as it is enough for the present for one to be on watch. But I cannot sleep. How can I, with the terrible danger hanging over my darling, and her going into that awful place? My only comfort is that we're in the hands of God. Only for that faith it would be easier to die than to live, and to be so quit of all the trouble. Mr. Morris and Dr. Seward were off on their long ride before we started. They are to keep up the right bank far enough to get on higher lands where they can see a good stretch of river and avoid the following of its curves. They have, for the first stages, two men to ride and lead their spare horses, four in all, so as not to excite curiosity. When they dismiss the men, which shall be shortly, they shall themselves look after the horses. It may be necessary for us to join forces if they can so mount our whole party. One of the saddles has a movable horn and can be easily adapted for Mina, if required. It was a wild adventure we are on. Here, as we are rushing along through the darkness, with the cold from the river seeming to rise up and strike us, with all the mysterious voices of the night around us, it all comes home. We seem to be drifting into unknown places and unknown ways, into a whole world of dark and dreadful things. Godalming is shutting the furnace door. 31st of October. Still hurrying along. The day has come, and Godalming is sleeping. I am on watch. The morning is bitterly cold. The furnace heat is grateful, though we have on heavy fur coats. As yet, we have passed only a few open boats, but none of them had any board or on board any box or package or anything like the size of the one we seek. The men were scared every time we turned our electric lamp on them and falled on their knees and prayed. 1st of November, evening. No news all day. We found nothing of the kind we seek. We've now passed into the Bistritza, and if we are wrong in our surmise, our chance is gone. We've overhauled every boat, big and little. Early this morning, one crew took us for a government boat and treated us accordingly. We saw this in a way of smoothing matters, so at Fundu, where the Bistritza runs into the Sereth, we got a Romanian flag, which we now fly conspicuously. With every boat which we've overhauled since then, this trick has succeeded. We've had every deference shown to us, and not once any objection to whatever we chose to ask or do. Some of the Slovaks tell us that a big boat passed them, going at more than usual speed as she had a double crew on board. This was before they came to Fundu, so they could not tell us whether the boat turned into the Bistritza or continued on up the Sereth. At Fundu, we could not hear of any such boat, so she must have passed in there in the night. I'm feeling very sleepy. The cold is perhaps beginning to tell upon me, and nature must have rest sometime. Godalming insists that he shall keep the first watch. God bless him for all of his goodness to poor dear Mina and me. 2nd of November, morning. It is broad daylight. That good fellow would not wake me. He says it would have been a sin too, for I slept so peacefully and was forgetting my trouble. It seems brutally selfish of me to have slept so long and let him watch all night, but he was quite right. I am a new man this morning. And as I sit here and watch him sleeping, all I can do, or I can do all that is necessary, both as to minding the engine, steering, and keeping watch. I can feel that my strength and energy are coming back to me. I wonder where Mina is now, and Van Helsing. They should have got to Veresti about noon on Wednesday. It would take them some time to get the carriage and horses, so if they had started and traveled hard, they would be about now at the Borgo Pass. God guide and help them. I'm afraid to think what may happen. If only we could go faster. But we cannot. The engines are throbbing and doing their utmost. I wonder how Dr. Seward and Mr. Morris are getting on. There seem to be endless streams running down the mountains into this river, but none of them are very large. At present, at all events, though they were terrible doubtless in winter and when the snow melts, the horsemen may not have met much obstruction. I hope that before we get to Strasbourg we may see them, for by if that time we have not overtaken the Count, it will be necessary to take counsel together what to do next. Dr. Seward's diary, 2nd of November. 3 days on the road. No news, no time to write, if there had been, for every moment is precious. We've had only the rest needful for the horses, but we're both bearing it wonderfully. Those adventurous days of ours are turning up useful. We must push on. We shall never feel happy till we get the launch in sight again. 3rd of November. We heard at Fundue that the launch had gone up to Bistritza. I wish it wasn't so cold. There are signs of snow coming, and if it falls heavy, it will stop us. In such case, we must get a sledge and go on Russian fashion. 4th of November. Today, we heard of the launch having been detained by an accident when trying to force a way up the rapid. The Slovak boats get up all right by aid of a rope and steering with knowledge. Some went up only a few hours before. Godalming is an amateur fitter himself, and evidently it was he who put the launch in trim again. Finally, they got up to the rapids all night with local help and are off on the chase afresh. I fear that the boat is not any better for the accident. The peasantry tell us that after she got on upon the water again, she kept stopping every now and again as long as she was in sight. We must push on harder than ever. Our help may be wanted soon. Mina Harker's Journal, 31st of October. Arrived at Veresti at noon. The professor tells me this morning at dawn he could hardly hypnotize me at all, and that all I could say was dark and quiet. He's off now, buying a carriage and horses. He says that he will later try to buy additional horses, so we may be able to change them on the way. We have something more than 70 miles before us. The country is lovely and most interesting. If only we were here under different circumstances, how delightful it would be to see it all. If Jonathan and I were driving through it alone, what a pleasure it would be. To stop and see people, to learn something of their life, to fill their minds and memories with all the color and picturesqueness of the whole world. Beautiful country, the quaint people. But alas. Later. Dr. Van Helsing has returned. He's got the carriage and horses. We're to have some dinner and start in an hour. The landlady is putting us up a huge basket of provisions. It seems enough for a company of soldiers. The professor encourages her and whispers to me that it might be a week before we get any good food again. He's been shopping, too, and has sent home such a wonderful lot of fur coats and wraps, all sorts of warm things. There will not be any chance at our being cold. We shall soon be off. I'm afraid to think of what may happen to us. We are truly in the hands of God. He alone knows what may be, and I pray him with all the strength of my sad and humble soul that he will watch over my beloved husband, that whatever may happen, Jonathan may know that I loved him and honored him more than I can say, and that my latest and truest thought will always be for him. Mina Harker's Journal, 1st of November. All day long we've traveled, and at good speed. The horses seem to know that they're being kindly treated, for they go willingly their full stage at best speed. We've now had so many changes and find the same thing so constantly that we are encouraged to think the journey will be an easy one. Dr. Van Helsing is laconic. He tells the farmers that he's hurrying to Bistritz and pays them well to make the exchange of horses. We get hot soup or coffee or tea and off we go. It's a lovely country, full of beauties of all imaginable kinds, and the people are brave and strong and simple and seem full of nice qualities. They are very, very superstitious. In the first house where we stopped, when the woman who served us saw the scar on my forehead, she crossed herself and put two fingers toward me to keep off the evil eye. I believe they went to the trouble of putting an extra amount of garlic into our food, and I can't abide garlic. Ever since I've taken care not to take off my hat and veil, and so I've escaped their suspicions. We're traveling fast, and as we have no driver with us to carry tales, we go ahead of scandal, but I dare say that the fear of the evil eye will follow us hard behind us all the way. The professor seems tireless. All day he would not take any rest, though he made me sleep for a long spell. At sunset time he hypnotized me, and he says that I answered, as usual, darkness, lapping water, and creaking wood, so our enemy is still on the river. I'm afraid to think of Jonathan, but somehow I have no fear for him or for myself. I write this whilst we wait in a farmhouse for the horses to get ready. Dr. Van Helsing is sleeping. Poor dear. He looks very tired and old and gray. but his mouth is set as firmly as a conqueror's. Even in his sleep, he is in instinct with resolution. When we have well started, I must make him rest while I drive. I shall tell him we have days before us, and he must not break down when most of his strength will be needed. All is ready, and we're off shortly. 2nd of November, morning. I was successful, and we took turns driving all night. Now the day is upon us, bright though cold. There is a strange heaviness in the air. I say heaviness for want of a better word. I mean that it oppresses us both. It's very cold, and only our warm furs keep us comfortable. At dawn, Van Helsing hypnotized me. He said I answered darkness, creaking wood, and roaring water. So the river's changing as they ascend. I do hope that my darling will not run into any chance of danger. More than need be, but we are in God's hands. 2nd of November, night. All day long driving. The country gets wilder as we go, and the great spurs of the Carpathians, which at Veresti seemed so far from us and so low on the horizon, now seem to gather around us and tower in front. We both seem in good spirits. I think we make an effort to cheer on the other, and in so doing, we cheer ourselves. Dr. Van Helsing says that by morning we shall reach the Borgo Pass. The houses are very few here now, and the professor says that the last horses we got will have to go on with us, as we may not be able to change. He got two in addition to the two we changed, so now we have a rude four in hand. The deer horses are patient and good and give us no trouble. We are not worried with other travelers, and so even I can drive. We shall get into the pass in daylight. We do not want to arrive before. So we take it easy and have each a long rest in turn. Oh, what will tomorrow bring to us? We go to seek the place where my poor darling suffered so much. God grant that we may be guided all right, and he will deign to watch over my husband and those dear to us both who are in such deadly peril. As for me, I'm not worthy in his sight. Alas, I am unclean to his eyes, and shall be, until he deign to let me stand forth in his sight as one of those who have not incurred his wrath. Memorandum by Abraham Van Helsing, 4th of November. This to my old and true friend, John Seward, M.D., of Purfleet, London, in case I may not see him. It may explain. It is morning, and I write by a fire which is all the night I have kept alive. Madam Mina is aiding me. It is cold. It's cold. So cold that the gray heavy sky is full of snow, which when it falls, all settle for all winter, as the ground is hardening to receive it. It seems to have affected Madam Mina. She has been so heavy of head all day, she is not like herself. She sleeps and sleeps and sleeps. She, who is usual so alert, have done nothing all the day. She even lost her appetite. She make no entry into her little diary. She, who writes so faithful at every pause. Something whisper to me that all is not well. However, tonight she is more vif. Her long sleep all day have refreshed and restored her, for now she is sweet and bright as ever. At sunset I tried to hypnotize her, but alas, with no effect. The power has grown less and less each day, and tonight it will fail me altogether. Well, God's will be done, whatever it may be, and whithersoever it may lead. Now to the historical, for Madam Mina may not write in her stenography. I must, in my cumbrous old fashion, that so each day to us may not go unrecorded. We got to the Borgo Pass just after sunrise yesterday morning. When I saw the signs of the dawn, I got ready for the hypnotism. We stopped our carriage and got down so there might be no disturbance. I made a couch with furs, and Madam Mina, lying down, yielded herself like usual, but more slow and start in short time than ever, to the hypnotic sleep. As before came the answer, darkness and the swirling of water. Then she woke, bright and radiant, and we go on our way and soon reach the pass. At this time and place she became all fire with zeal, some new guiding power in her be manifested, for she point to a road and say, "This is the way." "How do you know it?" I said. "Of course I know it," she answered, and with a pause add, "Have not my Jonathan travel and wrote of his travel?" At first I think somewhat strange, but I soon see there be only one such by-road. It is used but little, and very different from the coach road to Bukovina and Bistritz, which is wide and hard and more of use. So we came down this road, when we meet other ways. Not always sure that they were roads at all, for they be neglect, and light snow have fallen. The horses know, and they only. I give rein to them, and they go on so patient. By and by, we find all the things which Jonathan hath note in that wonderful diary of him. Then we go on for long, long hours and hours. At the first, I tell Madame Mina to sleep. She try, and she succeed. She sleep all the time, till at the last I feel myself too suspicious grow, and attempt to wake her. But she sleep on, and I may not wake her, though I try. I do not wish to try too hard, lest I harm her, for I know that she have suffered much, and I sleep at times be in all to her. I think I drowse myself, for all of a sudden I feel guilt, as though I done something. I find myself bolt up, and with the reins in my hand, and the good horses go along, jog, 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 just as ever. I look down, and find Madame Mina still asleep. It is now not too far off sunset time, and over the snow light of the sun flow in big yellow flood, for that we throw great long shadow on where the mountain rise so steep, for we are going up and up, and all is, oh, wild and rocky, as though it were end of the world. Then I arouse Madame Mina. This time she wake with not much trouble, and then I try to put her in hypnotic sleep. But she sleep not, being as though I were not. So still I try and try, till all at once I find her and myself in dark. So I look round, and find that the sun have gone down. Madame Mina laugh, and I turn and look at her. She is now quite awake, and looks so well I never saw her since that night at Carfax, when we first entered the Count's house. I am amazed, and know not at ease then. But she is bright and tender and thoughtful for me. I forget all fear. I light a fire, for we have brought supply of wood with us, and she prepare food while I undo the horses and set them, tethered in shelter, to feed. And then when I return to the fire, she have my supper ready. I go to help her, but she smile and tell me she will have eat already, that she was so hungry she could not wait. I like it not, and I have grave doubts, but I fear to affright her, so I am silent of it. She help me, and I eat alone, and then we wrap in fur and lie beside the fire. I tell her to sleep while I watch. But presently, I forgot all of watching, and when I sudden remember that I watch, I find her lying quiet, but awake, and looking at me with so bright eyes. Once, twice more, the same occur. I get much sleep till morning. When I wake, I try to hypnotize her, but alas, though she shut her eyes obedient, she may not sleep. The sun rise up and up and up, and then sleep come to her too late, but so heavy she will not wake. I have to lift her up and place her sleeping in the carriage when I've harnessed the horses and made all ready. Madam still sleep and sleep, and her look in sleep more healthy and redder than before. And I like it not. I am afraid, afraid, afraid. I am afraid of all things, even to think, but I must go my own way. The stake we play is for life and death, but more than these, and we must not flinch. 5th of November, morning. Let me be accurate in everything, for though you and I have seen some strange things together, you may at the first think that I, Van Helsing, am mad, that many horrors and so long strain of nerves has had the last turn my brain. All yesterday we travel, ever getting closer to the mountains, and moving into a more and more wild and desert land. There are great frowning precipices and much falling water, and nature seemed to have held sometime her carnival. Madame Mina still sleep and sleep, and though I did have hunger and appeased it, I could not waken her, even for food. I began to fear that the fatal spell of the place was upon her, tainted as she is with that vampire baptism. Well, I said to myself, if it be that she sleep all the day, it shall also be that I do not sleep at night. As we travel on the rough road, for a road of an ancient and imperfect kind there was, I held down my head and slept. Again I waked with a sense of guilt and of time past, and found Madame Mina still sleeping, and the sun low down. But all was indeed changed. The frowning mountains seemed further away, and we were near the top of a steep rising hill, on summit of which there was a castle, as Jonathan did tell of in his diary. At once I exulted and feared, for now, for good or ill, the end was near. I woke Madame Mina, and again tried to hypnotize her, but alas, unavailing, till too late. Till ere the great dark came upon us, for even after down sun the heavens reflected the gone sun on the snow, and all was for a time in a great twilight. I took out the horses and fed them in what shelter I could. Then I make a fire, and near it I make Madame Mina, now awake and more charming than ever, sit comfortable amid her rugs. I got ready food, but she would not eat, simply saying she had not hunger. I did not press her, knowing her unavailingness, but I myself eat, for I must needs now be strong for all. Then, with the fear of me on me of what might be, I drew a ring so big for her comfort, round where Madame Mina sat, and over the ring I passed some of the wafer, and I broke it fine so that all was well guarded. She sat still all the time, as still as one dead, and she grew whiter and whiter till the snow was not more pale, and no word she said. But when I drew near, she clung to me, and I could know that that poor soul shook from head to feet with a tremor that was pain to feel. I said to her presently, when she'd grown more quiet, "Will you not come over to the fire?" For I wished to make a test of what she could. She rose, obedient, but when she made a step, she stopped and stood as one stricken. "Why not go on?" I asked. She shook her head, and coming back, sat down in her place. Then, looking at me with open eyes as one waked from sleep, she simply said, "I cannot," and remained silent. I rejoiced, for I knew that what she could not, none of those that we dreaded could. Though there might be danger in her body, yet her soul was safe. Presently, the horses began to scream and tore at their tethers till I came round to them and quiet them. When they did feel my hands on them, they whinnied low as in joy and licked my hands and were quiet for some time. Many times through the night did I come to them till it arrived to the cold hour when all nature is at lowest, and every time my coming was with quiet of them. In the cold hour the fire began to die, and I was about stepping forth to replenish it, for now the snow came in flying sweeps, and with it a chill mist. Even in the dark there was a light of some kind, as ever there is over snow, and it seemed as though the snow flurries and the wreaths of mist took shape as of women with trailing garments. All was in dead, grim silence, only that the horses whinnied and cowered as if in terror of the worst. I began to fear, horrible fears, but then came to me the sense of safety in that ring wherein I stood. I began, too, to think of my imaginings were of the night and the gloom and the unrest that I have gone through, and all the terrible anxiety. It was as though my memories of all Jonathan's horrid experiences were befooling me, for the snowflakes and the mist began to wheel and circle round till I could get as though a shadowy glimpse of those women that would have kissed him. And then the horses cowered longer and lower and moaned in terror as men do in pain. Even the madness of fright was not to them so that they could break away. I feared for my dear Madam Mina when these weird figures drew near and circled round. I looked at her, but she sat calm and smiled at me. When I would have stepped to the fire to replenish it, she caught me and held me back, and whispered, like a voice one hears in a dream, so low it was, "No, no, do not go without. Here you are safe." I turned to her and looked her in the eyes and said, "But you, it is for you I fear." Whereat she laughed, a laugh low and unreal, and said, "Fear for me? Why fear for me? None safer in all the world from them as I am." And as I wondered the meaning of her words, a puff of wind made the flame leap up, and I could see the red scar on her forehead. Then, alas, I knew. Did I not, I would have soon learned, for the wheeling figures of mist and snow came closer, but keeping ever without the holy circle. Then they began to materialize, till, if God could have taken away my reason, for I saw it through my eyes, there before me in actual flesh the same three women that Jonathan saw in the room when they would have kissed his throat. I knew the swaying round forms, the bright hard eyes, the white teeth, the ruddy color, the voluptuous lips. They smiled ever at poor dear Madam Mina, and as their laugh came through the silence of the night, they twined their arms and pointed at her, and said in those sweet tingling tones that Jonathan said were of the intolerable sweetness of the water glasses, "Come, sister, come to us, come, come." In fear, I turned to my dear Madam Mina, and my heart with gladness leapt like flame, for, oh, the terror in her sweet eyes, the repulsion, the horror, told a story to my heart that was all of hope. God be thanked, she was not yet of them. I seized some of the firewood which was by me, and holding out some of the wafer, advanced on them towards the fire. They drew back before me and laughed their low, horrid laugh. I fed the fire and feared them not, for I knew we were safe within our protections. They could not approach me whilst so armed, nor Madam Mina whilst she remained in the ring, which she could not leave no more than they could enter. The horses had ceased to moan and lay on the ground. The snow fell on them softly, and they grew whiter. I knew that there was for the poor beasts no more of terror. And so we remained till the red of the dawn began to fall through the snow gloom. I was desolate and afraid, and full of woe and terror, but when that beautiful sun began to climb the horizon, life was to me again. At the first coming of dawn, the horrid figures melted in the whirling mist and snow, the wreaths of transparent gloom moved away toward the castle and were lost. Instinctively, with the dawn coming, I turned to Madame Mina, intending to hypnotize her, but she lay in a deep and sudden sleep from which I could not wake her. I tried to hypnotize through her sleep, but she made no response, none at all, and the day broke. I fear yet to stir. I have made my fire and seen the horses. They are all dead. Today I have much to do here. I keep waiting till the sun is up high, for there may be places where I must go, where that sunlight, though snow and mist obscure it, will be to me a safety. I will strengthen me with breakfast, and then I will to my terrible work. Madame Mina still sleeps, and God be thanked, she is calm in her sleep. This has been Rachel Reading Bookshelf with Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.